delighted to say that I'm not the only one in the studio right now. I have to be on my best behaviour because I have two ladies sitting across the way from me. The two A's, the two Anns, one with an E and one without. Anne Murray and Anne Neville, you're very welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Dara.
Thanks, Dara.
Delighted to have you here, and what a resplendent day to be here then on Halloween.
Absolutely, and the feast of Blessed Dominic Collins, our local man.
Indeed. Now, before I get into it, I just want to refer to a message that came in from one of our listeners saying, well done to Simeon Burke, who I spoke just before the break with about the blasphemy law that has been removed from the Constitution. But we're here today to talk about Blessed Dominic Collins. He was actually born here in Youghal in 1566. Now, a little bit before our time, I know that. But he was executed here in Youghal as well on this day.
In 1602.
So tell us, guys, a little bit about Dominic Collins and, you know, what it means to the community of Youghal to have, you know, somebody that has been beatified by Pope John Paul II.
Well, Dominic Collins, he was born here in Youghal, as you already said. His father and his brother were both Lord Mayors of Youghal. He came from a fairly wealthy family here in the town. And Youghal was a very prominent town at the time. It was a period one of the most important market towns and fishing ports in the south of Ireland. And as we all know, it was a stone wall and enclosed. Now, the people of Youghal at the time, they accepted the Queen as their ruler. But they, as long as she didn't interfere much with their liberties and what they were at, but they were not willing to accept her new religion that she was trying to impose on them. And they wanted the Pope, they saw the Pope, he was the head of the church, not the Queen of England. And we had two friaries in the town at the time. We had the Franciscans here in South Abbey and we had the Dominicans in North Abbey.
So we also had the Benedictines there, it was the local hotel where the Priory tea shop is.
With the Priory, right, with the Benedictines,
yeah, too. Yeah, that was the guest house.
More than me.
I always say two minds are better than one.
Two minds are always better than one.
And then we had the ships coming and going all the time because it was one of the most important medieval town or ports in the British Isles, which was quite amazing when you think back, really, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, at the time then it was... at that time, you had to kind of either conform to the English rule. Things were kind of rough at the time. And the customs and the religion, or you had to leave the country. If you didn't conform, like, I suppose it was probably at the time death, if you didn't conform. Mm. So Blessed Dominic decided that he would leave the country. And he was only 20.
And he went to France.
He went to France. He got a space on a ship and he went overland then to the town of Nantes in Brittany, which is a beautiful town, I'm told.
No, I think he went to Spain first, actually, didn't he?
He went to France, Spain after,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, because he did very, very well in the French army. I think he first worked as an innkeeper when he went to Nantes, because he had to get some money.
Yes, he had to get into the army, he had to have his own horse and his own uniform. He had to pay for all of them himself. So he did have to work, yes, as an innkeeper to raise the money to actually buy all these things so that he could become a member of the...
And having had 9 years in the military, and he became a captain and a military governor. So he moved up the ranks pretty quick.
And that's what I find very interesting, that, you know, he probably had limited enough education here in Youghal, because at the time Catholics weren't being educated. And the only bit of education that he would have got, the Jesuits set up a school here for about 2 years. And that was his own... And he learned Latin there and that, so... That certainly helped him. But then he became governor of the area and he was really, really highly thought of. And when, I think there was a bit of corruption, I suppose, what has changed in political life, in politics. And he wasn't comfortable.
Sounds like today, actually. Things haven't changed much, have they?
No.
And it was because of that, really, that he didn't feel comfortable remaining on in his position as governor in France. So he decided to head for Spain.
That was the Spanish connection, and that's where he met Father White.
That's right.
A Jesuit priest.
Yeah. Who was born, he was an Irishman, born in Clonmel in 1558.
A good Tipperary man.
Yeah, a good Tipperary man, yeah. He came to Spain, then he founded a college in Salamanca to educate young Irishmen. I suppose a lot of Irishmen had probably travelled over there at the time because they left Ireland. And he was especially interested in those who wanted to study for the priesthood. And shortly after he founded that college, he became a member of the Society of Jesus, which is, are the Jesuits, the Father, this is Father Thomas White.
And it was Father White then that encouraged Dominic Collins to become a Jesuit brother.
Mm-hmm. I think he tried a few other communities first, but they weren't inclined to accept him. Now, I suppose his lack of education
yeah.
had a certain, I think, bearing on
it. I think when he met Father White, he kind of liked what they were, you know, what they were
what they offer, were about.
I suppose, and what they were about. And he said to Father White, he said, I have been to others and met other priests along my journey, he said, but what you have is what I have find a calling for. He said, and he was a high-ranking officer, but he felt this calling to the religious.
And I suppose, in a way, when you think of it, that he had a freedom to practice his religion over there, something that was denied to Catholics back home here in Ireland.
Yeah, and indeed in England as well at the same time. It was the same both England and Ireland.
I know now I'm digressing ever so slightly, but I have memories of my grandmother telling me back in penal times that a cousin of hers used row the priest from the East Ferry side of Middleton over to the Mass Rock in Cove for people to attend Mass in secret for fear, you know, that they may be arrested or worse. So, you know, even though a few centuries apart, things were still pretty grim when it came to the practice of religion.
Oh, there were. I mean, right up until the early 1800s. And I suppose in some ways, y'all, it's a bit remarkable that our parish church was built before Catholic emancipation. It's the oldest Catholic church in the diocese. And it showed that there was probably a certain liberty here, or kind of
there
certain freedom
something. Yes.
In comparison to others. But, you know, yeah, I mean, for Catholics, they couldn't practice freely.
Something that we take for granted today.
Exactly.
Now, when Dominic became a Jesuit brother, he came back to Ireland during the Battle of Kinsale.
And he became a Jesuit brother, sorry to go back into there, because he wanted to become a Jesuit priest, but he didn't have the education and he was told he was too old by the time he'd be educated. So they told him he would become a Jesuit brother. He had to fight to become a Jesuit brother even, and they told him he'd have to have menial tests and be at the lowest rank, and they accepted him for, I think, 3 or 6 months to see what he would be, how he would get on. And as a Jesuit brother, they thought he'd be a 9 days wanderer, but he wouldn't. So they were actually surprised with him. And after the 6 months, he was accepted as a Jesuit.
I mean, when you think about it, he was extremely bright, had done so well in the French army and served a bit in the Spanish as well, I think. And here he was kind of mopping floors, looking after the sick, those that were dying.
They were struck with plague at the time when he landed, and he was looking after them. Yeah,
he was really, working at the bottom level, if you want to call
and
it that.
And he remained there
know.
For 2 years, he was doing that kind
and
of
did
work.
It with such joy and love. I think that's what really impressed them.
I think so, yes.
But coming back to Ireland, of course, acceptance wasn't going to be, wouldn't have been for him. I mean,
well, he was actually chosen or picked to come back on behalf of the Jesuits, because at the time, the Irish were trying to beat the British.
Yeah. And the Spaniards were sending over a fleet to help them.
So he was chosen
to help the Irish rebels.
By the Spanish to come on that fleet to assist the Irish. So he came, I suppose, to give spiritual assistance, and obviously being Irish was going to be a huge help to him when they landed in Kinsale.
And I think they know that he had the military kind of background too, as well as that. So, like I said, he was back in the ranks of a soldier, but he was dressed in the Dominican or the Jesuit robes.
But back here in Youghal then, he was asked to renounce.
Yeah, he went first to Kinsale, the Battle of Kinsale. And the Battle of Kinsale, and of course, as we all know, the Irish rebels, they lost the Battle of Kinsale after fierce fighting. And there were some of them caught down in a cellar, we'll say. So he decided he would come out with the white flag, hoping that he would save those few that were left. But they captured them all.
And that's when he went to Bearhaven then fell back with O'Sullivan Bear. And the last big battle then of the Irish Lords, the Battle of Dunboy, before all the Irish Lords left. So it was there in Dunboy he was captured, and he offered himself up in exchange for some of the officers who were married with children, but the British wouldn't accept and decided that, you know, there was a huge price in his head because he was a Jesuit and he was worth capturing. So then they captured him and the two others. I think they killed the two others, others first.
They killed the two others first, they did, yeah.
Back in June.
Was the name then, of the man. He was obviously
a soldier. He was kind of the general of the English army.
Exactly.
And he landed the little island across from the mainland, Bear Island. He landed there, brought his troops across, and there was 141 Irish people surrounded by 4,000 British soldiers. So that was something. And they held out for quite a length of time. But then, Dominic was captured and brought to Cork Prison.
And he wasn't killed with the others, because Carew decided that it would be much better for him in his own career if he could get Dominic, a Jesuit brother, to renounce Catholicism and turn over to Protestantism.
And of course, Dominic was threatened, cajoled, but he was also offered treasures. They even brought his family in to see would he renounce his Catholic belief. And he was not for turning back.
He was not having it.
It's amazing, really, when you think about it. I mean, knowing that, you know, he was facing certain death if he didn't renounce. And I mean, his family said to him, look, pretend you're going to give it up, you know, and save your life.
And he was executed here in Youghal on the 31st of October, 1602. And an English officer who witnessed his death said, he is going to his death as eagerly as I would go to a banquet. But Dominic, as it is told, replied, yes, for this cause I would be willing to die not once, but 1,000 deaths. I mean, that is a sure testimony, a profession of faith, that he wasn't for turning back. You know, he knew where he was going. He was going to his God, and he wasn't going to be, you know, you can threaten me all you want. In many respects, I suppose you could almost compare this tragedy to almost like Christ on the cross. When he would have been in the Garden of Gethsemane, he would have been tempted, you know, and he would have had doubts himself. Father, you know, if it be your will, take this cup away from me, but let your will, not mine, be done. So in many respects, you know, this is...
It was a pure expression of his true faith, really. Like, do you know what I mean? He really believed 110%, like he knew where he was going.
Now, I can remember, ladies, back in 1997, when the late, great Saint Pope John Paul II beatified Dominic Collins. And I remember there was a lot of excitement about that, you know, and it was a great blessing that, you know, somebody from the Diocese of Cloyne was being beatified. How is his life remembered here in Youghal now? I mean, do people actually grasp, you know, the importance of this man's life and more so this man's sacrifice?
Well, in 2002, there was a plaque put up at the site of his hanging on the North Main Street. And remember that night there was a huge crowd and the Jesuits came. And I live near the plaque. And I do know that people do stop. They do bless themselves passing it. They do say a prayer. Not every, you would see, you know, I have seen people do it. So people are aware of it. But I suppose really it's to be people come more aware of it. And like, it's up to us to promote him and to pray for his canonisation, because he is there. He was a man of Youghal. And I do firmly believe if we pray to him as people of Youghal, he will help us.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's very appropriate then. And it's a nice little lead in, if you will. He was executed on what we call Halloween, which was actually All Hallows Eve. Tomorrow is the Feast of All Saints, and the day after, All Souls.
Yes.
So let's move. We'll still remember Dominic Collins, but let's move into...
Just before you move, can I just say like that, when he said that he'd be willing to die 1,000 deaths, the hangman, he said it with such belief and such, the hangman would not do his job. And he ran away. And they had to pull a fisherman and make him do the job. And the fisherman asked for his forgiveness, and he said, "I forgive you." He, you know, the person that hung him, it's a bit like the man that was called to carry our Lord's cross. You know, the hangman ran when he said that. That'll tell you the hangman knew there was something about this man.
Or the second thief on the cross that turned to our Lord and said, "Look, we're here because we've done wrong. Remember me when you come into your kingdom."
Yes.
Now, look, a lot is said in society, lads, here in Ireland, that, you know, we become very Americanized on a lot of things. And I suppose that's fair to say when you look at the whole celebration, if you will, of Halloween. Now, in my day growing up, it was a case of putting on a black bag. And, you know, you put on some sort of a mask. Yeah. I didn't need a mask because I'm just naturally scary. But, you know, you went
Don't say that about yourself, Darren.
I know. Well, others would say it's so I can get in before them. But, you know, you went from house to house and you got your few monkey nuts and you got your few sweets and you came home. You played Snap Apple. You know, that back in the day when there was a 10p of florin, and I had a chat with Noel Cronin on this last Saturday down at Tesco. The florin was inside in the apple and you try and get that. Or sometimes you'd be blindfolded.
Yes.
And it could be a piece of coal that you were actually biting into. That was back in the day. Now, you know, people, and I was listening to Joe Duffy on Liveline today, listening to people, callers, talking about Mount St. Jerome's Cemetery, where families were decorating graves with skeletons and bats and all sorts of weird and wonderful and crazy stuff. And I get the feeling people really don't understand what they're actually getting themselves into. So let's just talk very briefly in the time we've left about what the real meaning of Halloween is and what we shouldn't let ourselves be open to mistaking what it could be. And take it away.
Well, I suppose the meaning of Halloween is Eve of All Saints Day, which is what we have. Tomorrow is All Saints Day. And the tradition of All Saints goes back to the Catholic Church, goes back, in fact, to 1609, when the Pope at the time consecrated the Pantheon in Rome, which is now a church, but was on the site of an old kind of Roman temple. So it became Catholic, and it kind of was the 13th of May when the Romans kind of looked after their ancestral spirits. Then a couple of hundred years later, Gregory III, another pope, consecrated the Church of Peter and the Saints to All Saints. And it was Pope Gregory IV who inaugurated, if you like, or introduced to the entire Catholic Church worldwide the Feast of All Saints on the 1st of November. So then Halloween became, if you like, Christmas Eve of All Saints Day, because we were celebrating all the saints all over, you know, the world. And then subsequently, the 2nd of November became All Souls. So for Catholics, it's a celebration of the saints in heaven. And also we remember our family dead who've gone before us and remember to pray for them. So the Catholic faith was very party-ish, if you like. There was a lot of celebrations in Europe. And there was festivals and that. So in France, they decided to start dressing up for All Saints. In Britain, the eve before All Saints Day, so that's Halloween, youngsters would have gone around to houses, knocking on the door, offering what they call a soul cake. And they would have then prayed for the dead of the person in the house, you know, maybe a family member and that. In Ireland, the people went around with turnips, with little lanterns in them, again, offering to pray for the souls of the dead. So there was kind of this kind of festive spirit. But then, of course, when Catholicism was kind of frowned upon and that went kind of underground a little bit. And it wasn't until people went to the States and you had all the different nationalities going there, and the Protestants were kind of poo-pooing this Catholic festival. So it kind of, you know, wasn't really encouraged. And then suddenly, in true American form, they discovered that Halloween could be kind of
another party.
You know, they could make money out of it. Mm. So it kind of started off as a neighbourhood kind of party. So the soul cake became trick or treat. The turnips, which they didn't have in the United States, became the pumpkins. And the French brought the dressing up, so they started dressing up. So, of course, that evolved then into people could make money out of it and into what we have now. So it started in the States and then came back to Ireland, I suppose, in particular, in Britain, in what we have now. But the real roots are rooted in the Festival of All Saints. All Saints Day is tomorrow. Holy Day of Obligation for Catholics. And this evening is the eve where we remember.
And there's always a tradition that you light a candle in your house, a candle at home tonight, the Eve of All Saints and the Eve of All Souls for all those who've passed and for all the saints.
You see, this whole sort of, and I use this term loosely, this whole sort of a Hollywood approach to Halloween. A backlash against Halloween by non-Catholic Christians began in the 1980s, in part because of claims that Halloween was the devil's night. And it's not the devil's night.
Absolutely.
There is no night called the devil's night. What was interesting, actually, on the Late Late Show last Friday night, Ryan Tuberty had some guests on who were involved in paranormal activity, and one of whom works with dioceses around the country in trying to exorcise evil spirits. There's almost a sort of this, fascination in that, you know, there's no such thing as evil. There's no such thing as these spirits out there. When people are actually not informed, they don't realise what they're leaving themselves open to and what they are getting themselves into. Mm. And I think it's because they're using this whole Halloween style, the spooky, the scary and all this, that they're allowing people to be open to all sorts of things that they're not prepared for.
And they don't realise what they're getting into, as you said.
Yeah. Mm. And certainly, I mean, from a Catholic perspective, you know, Ouija boards and other spirits, you know, are not frowned upon for good reason. Because as you said, Dara, you're letting yourself open to other spirits. And indeed, Pope Francis has, you know, spoken many times about the devil, maybe much more so than many other popes, for good reason. I think we are probably have, as you say, that fascination with the dark side. And leaving unwittingly ourselves open. And that's why it's nice to remember Halloween as its true meaning, the Eve of All Saints, where we celebrate, you know, the light, the brightness. We pray for the souls of the dead. Of course, the 2nd of November is All Souls Day, and we remember those that are still waiting to head into heaven.
Right through the month of November.
Yes.
I know priests all over the Diocese of Cloyne will celebrate 12 Masses each in memory of people who have gone before us. And I suppose, look, it's timely to kind of, I know time is against us. There's a Mass tonight in the Holy Family Church at 7:30, which is part of almost like a triduum of Masses in remembrance of Blessed Dominic Collins. And maybe it's timely, you know, whether you have a faith or whether you don't, you know, you have loved ones out there who have departed this world to the next. Maybe it's timely to, rather than all the spookiness and all the crazy stuff, maybe light a candle tonight.
Yes.
Even if you don't believe, just light a candle in remembrance of your loved one. And I suppose always remember, they're always with you.
They certainly are. You know, and again, on Sunday, there'll be prayers for the dead in North Abbey Cemetery here in Yall at 3
every
and out
Sunday.
In Gertrude at 4 every Sunday for November. I know many people just love, you know, to come to the graveyard and remember the dead, and it's, I think it's a lovely, lovely tradition.
It is really, and like you say about people remember the dead, there's always a mass, there's mass every week, but in November there's one special mass for all those that died the year before. And, you know, we all have people, the church is always thronged, so like people do want to remember their dead and want to pray for them, and this is the month.
Well, look, ladies, I could talk to you forever, and we'll talk a little bit more off air. But thanks so much for coming in and for sort of sharing the spotlight or putting a spotlight on Dominic Collins. Mm. I suppose that's something we all need to do from our respective communities and towns. You know, let's hold on to those that have gone before us. And, you know, there was a time when to go to Mass was a crime, and these people gave their lives so that we could have that sense of freedom.
Yeah.
Anne-Marie and Neville, you'll be back again on Monday, of course.
I will, Dara.
I don't know when you'll be back, Anne-Marie. I know I'll be back next Wednesday. I suppose it's timely for me to wrap up. I want to thank all my guests. I want to thank the two Anns who've come in today. I want to thank Simeon Burke, who I spoke to from NUIG Galway, to Michael Beecher, who was in earlier, talking about the Greenway and the rail line. Just another couple of comments there. Simeon made very valid comments. Our government is totally misrepresentative. Well, that's probably true. I'll be back again to do it all again next Wednesday on Drive Time. And until then, to all the team and all the crew here at CRY, have a great weekend. And if you're out trick-or-treating, accept the monkey nuts.